Wayne tugged on his lucky hat. It was a coachman's hat, something like a wide-brimmed bowler, only one that didn't have 3 ounces of fancy shoved up its backside. He nodded to himself in his mirror, then wiped his nose. He'd started storing up health the day before, just after finding all those corpses. He already had a nice cushion of healing he could draw upon, tucked away in his metal mind bracers. He hadn't needed much lately, and always spent days when he had a hangover as sickly as he could manage, since he was going to have an awful time of it anyway. But the way things smelled, with all those important folk dead, warned him. He'd soon need some healing. Best to expand that cushion as he could. He went light at it today, though, because it was today, a day when he was going to need some luck. He was tempted to call it the worst day of his life, but that would certainly be an exaggeration. The worst day of his life would be the one when he died.
Might die today, though.
He looped on his belt and slipped his dueling canes into their straps, then wiped his nose again. Can't be certain yet. Every man had to die. He'd always found it odd that so many died when they were old, as logic said that was the point in their lives when they'd had the most practice not dying. He wandered out of his room in Wax's mansion, idly noticing the scent of morning bread coming from the kitchens. He appreciated the room, though he really only stayed because of the free food. Well, that and because of Wax. The man needed company to keep him from going more strange. Wayne wandered down a carpeted corridor that smelled of polished wood and servants who had too much time. The mansion was nice, but really, a man shouldn't live in a place that was so big. It just reminded him how small he was. Give Wayne nice cramped quarters and he'd be happier. That way he'd feel like a king with so much stuff it crowded him. He hesitated outside the door to Wax's study. What was that sitting on the stand beside the doorway? A new candelabra, pure gold, with a white lace doily underneath. Exactly what Wayne needed. He fished in his pocket. Rich people didn't make sense at all. That candelabra was probably worth a fortune, and Wax just left it lying around. Wayne fished in his other pocket, looking for something good to trade, and came out with a pocket watch.
Ah, that.
He shook it.
How long since this thing actually told time?
He picked up the candelabra, pocketed the doily underneath, then put the candelabra back in place with the pocket watch hanging from it. Seemed like a fair trade.
Me needin' a new handkerchief.
He blew his nose into it, then pushed open the door and wandered in. Wax stood before an easel, looking at the large artist's sketch pad he had filled with intricate plans.
Up all night, were you? Rust, man, you make it hard to loaf about properly.
I don't see what my insomnia has to do with your laziness, Wayne.
Makes me look bad, Saul.
Wayne looked over Wax's shoulder.
Proper loafing requires company. One man lying about is being idle. Two men lying about is a lunch break.
Wax shook his head, walking over to look at some broadsheets. Wayne leaned in, inspecting Wax's paper. It held long lists of ideas, some connected by arrows, with a sketch of the way the bodies had fallen in both the ballroom and the safe room.
What's all this, then?
Wayne picked up a pencil and drew a little stick figure with a gun shooting at all the dead bodies. His hand trembled as he drew the stick gun, but otherwise it was a right good stick figure.
Proof to me that a steel runner is involved. Look at the pattern of deaths in the ballroom. 4 of the most powerful people in the room were killed with the same gun, and they were the only ones up there killed by that weapon. But it's the same one that killed the guards outside the safe room. I bet those 4 above were shot first, dead in an eye blink, so fast it sounded like a single long shot. Thing is, judging by the wounds, each shot came from a different location.
Wayne didn't know a lot about guns, seeing as how he couldn't try to use one without his arm doing an impersonation of a carriage on a bumpy road, but Wax was probably right. Wayne moved down to start sketching some stick figures of topless women in the center of the picture, but Wax stepped over and plucked the pencil from his fingers.
What's that?
Wayne tapped the center of the sketch pad where Wax had drawn a bunch of straight lines.
The pattern the killer used baffles me. The 4 people in the party he shot, they all fell while in random conversations. Look how they were lying. Everyone else who died was part of the larger shootout, but these 4, they died while the party was still going on. But why did he shoot them from different directions? See, best I can guess, he fired first here, killing Lady Lenten. Her dropped drink was stomped on many times over the next few minutes, but then the killer used his speed to move quickly over here and fire in another direction. Then he moved again, and again. Why four shots from different places?
Who was standing where he shot?
The people he killed, obviously.
No, I mean who was standing near him when he fired his gun? Not who did he shoot, but who was he near when he shot?
Yep. Looks to me like he was trying to set them all off. Get everybody in the room shooting at each other. See? It's like how, to start a bar fight, you throw a bottle at some fella and then turn to the person next to you and cry out, "Hey, why'd you throw that bottle at that nice fella? Rusty looks big, and now he's coming for you."
I understand the concept.
Wax tapped the drawing pad.
You might have something.
It's not catching.
Wax smiled, writing some notes on the side of the pad.
So the killer wanted to sow chaos. He started a firefight by bouncing around the room, making it look like various parties were attacking one another. They would have already been tense, suspicious of one another.
Yep, I'm a genius.
You just recognize this because the killer was making others do his work for him, which is an expertise of yours.
As I said, genius. So how are you going to find him?
Well, I was thinking of sending you to the village to...
Not today.
Wax turned to him, raising his eyebrows.
It's the first of the month.
Ah, I had forgotten. You don't need to go every month.
I do.
Wax studied him, as if waiting for a further comment or wisecrack. Wayne said nothing. This was actually serious. Slowly, Wax nodded.
I see. Then why haven't you left yet?
Well, you know, it's like I often say.
Greet every morning with a smile. That way it won't know what you're planning to do to it?
No, not that one.
Until you know it ain't true, treat every woman like she has an older brother, what is stronger than you are?
No, not... Wait, I said that?
Yes.
Wax turned back to his notes.
It was a very chivalrous moment for you.
Huh. Rusts, I should really write these things down.
I believe that is another thing you often say. Unfortunately, you'd have to first learn how to write.
Now that's unfair.
Wayne walked over to Wax's desk and poked around in its drawers.
I can't write. I know four whole letters, and one's not even in my name.
Are you going to tell me what you always say?
Wayne found a bottle in the bottom drawer and lifted it up, dropping in the lace doily he'd taken from outside as a replacement.
If you're going to have to do something awful, stop by Wax's room and trade for some of his rum first.
I don't believe you've ever said that.
I just did.
I have no response to that.
Wax set down his pencil.
However, since you're going to be indisposed, then I suppose I will have to go visit the village.
Sorry, I know you hate that place.
I'll survive.
Want a piece of advice?
From you? Probably not. But please feel free.
Wayne trailed out toward the door.
You should probably stop by Wax's room before you go and pinch some of his rum.
The rum you just pocketed?
Wayne hesitated, then took the rum out of his pocket.
Ah, mate, sorry. Tough for you.
He shook his head. He pulled the door closed behind him, took a pull on the rum, and continued on his way down the stairs and out of the mansion. Marcy tugged at the collar of her jacket, glad for the seaborne wind that blew across her. It could get warm in her uniform, a proper one today with a buttoned white blouse and brown skirt to match the brown coat. Next to her, the newsman wasn't so thankful for the wind.
Rust and ruin!
He threw a heavy chunk of iron onto his stack of broadsheets. On the street, the traffic slowed in a moment of congestion. The newsman looked at the traffic.
Ruin break that Tim machine! And his machines!
It's hardly his fault.
Marcy dug into her pocketbook.
It is! Motors were fine. Nothing wrong with them for driving in the country or on a summer afternoon. But they're cheap enough now, everyone has to have one of the rusting things. A man can't take his horse two blocks without being run down half a dozen times.
Marcy exchanged coins for a broadsheet. The traffic lot loosened, horses and machines once again flowing across the cobbles. She raised the broadsheet, scanning above the fold for stories.
Say, weren't you just here?
I needed the afternoon edition.
Marcy walked away from him.
Cry of outrage in the streets. A cry like that of twisting metal sounds through Ellendale as people take to the streets, outraged by government corruption. 1 week after the governor's veto of Bill 775, the so-called Workers' Rights Manifesto, his brother, Winston Innate, has been found dead after an apparent dealing with known criminals. Winston was killed in his mansion, perhaps a casualty of constable action against these criminal elements. Among the fallen is the notorious Dowser Moline, long suspected of running ore smuggling operations into the city, undercutting the work of honest men. The constables admit no culpability for the deaths, but suspicions about the mysterious circumstances have led to a general outcry.
Marcy reached into her handbag and took out the morning edition of the same paper.
Mystery at Lord Winston's mansion. Constables have disclosed that Lord Winston, brother of the governor, was found dead in his mansion home last night. Little is known of the mysterious circumstances of the death, though several members of high society are rumored to have been present.
Every other story in the paper was the same in both editions, save for one report on the floods in the east, which had an extra line updating casualty estimates. The Winston story had nudged two others off the page, in part because of the size of its headline. The Ellendale Daily was hardly the most reputable news source in the basin, but it did know its market. News stories that people agreed with, or were scared by, sold the most copies. Marcy hesitated on the steps of the 4th Octant precinct of the constabulary. People flowed on the sidewalks, bustling, anxious, heads down. Others loitered nearby, men in the dark jackets of Teamsters, hands shoved in pockets, eyes shaded by peaked hats.
Out of work.
Too many idle men out of work. Motor cars and electric lights were changing life in Ellendale so quickly it seemed that the common man had no hope of keeping up. Men whose families had worked for three generations in the same job suddenly found themselves unemployed. And with the labor disputes at the steel mills, the governor had recently given political speeches to these men, making promises. More coach lines to compete with rail lines, going places the railroad could not. Higher tariffs on imports from Bilming. Empty promises, mostly, but men losing hope clung to such promises. Winston's death could dash those promises. How would the people react if they began to wonder if the governor, Replar Innate, was as corrupt as his brother?
A fire is kindling in the city.
She could almost feel the heat coming off the page of the broadsheet in her hands. She turned and entered the constabulary offices, worrying that Lord Winston might actually do more harm to Ellendale dead than he had alive, which was saying something. Wax climbed out of the carriage, nodding to his coachman and indicating that the man should continue on home rather than wait for his master. Wax pulled on his aluminum-lined hat, broad-brimmed, Ruffs style, matching his duster, though he wore a fine shirt and cravat underneath. The hat and mist coat made him stand out like a man who had brought a shotgun to a knife fight. Workers passed in suspenders and caps, bankers in vests and monocles, constables in helms or bowlers and militaristic coats. No Ruffs hats. Maybe Wayne was right about that. He never would shut up about the importance of a hat. Wax stepped into the village. It had probably once been just an ordinary city street. A wide one, but still just a street. That was before the trees. They sprouted here, pushing cobblestones aside, creating a dense canopy that ran the length of the thoroughfare. It was a place that felt like it shouldn't be. No mere park. This was a forest, uncultivated and unmanicured, fresh and primal. You couldn't bring a carriage or motor into the village. Even without the trees, the ground would be too rough now, rolling and uneven. The buildings along the street had been engulfed and become the property of the village. He couldn't help wondering if this was what all of Ellendale would be like without the hand of men. Harmony had made the basin ferociously fecund. Men didn't farm here so much as fight to harvest quickly enough. Wax strode forward, arrayed as if for battle. Vindication and Hysterion at his hips, short-barreled shotgun in its holster on his thigh, metal burning inside of him. He pulled the brim of his hat low and entered another world. Children wearing simple white smocks played among the trees. Older youths wore the tinning dar, the terrace robe marked with a V pattern running down the front. These looked up from the steps of buildings to watch him pass. The air smelled soft here. Soft air. A stupid metaphor. And yet there it was. That smell reminded him of his mother. Wax kept his eyes forward, trudging across the too springy ground. There were no gates into or out of the village, yet you couldn't enter or leave without being identified. Indeed, moments after his entry, a young woman with streaming golden hair was sent running ahead of him to bear news of his arrival.
They've found peace for themselves here. They've made peace for themselves. You shouldn't resent them so.
After a short walk, he emerged from a stand of trees to find three terrasmen waiting for him, arms folded, all wearing the robes of brutes, ferrochemists who could increase their strength. Their features were varied enough that one wouldn't have pegged them as relatives. Two had the height that was often the Terrace heritage, and one had skin that was darker. Some of the originators from ancient Terrace had been dark of skin. Wax's own tan probably came from that lineage. None of the men here had the elongated features seen in the ancient paintings. That was a thing of mythology.
What is it you need, outsider?
I want to speak with the Synod.
Are you a constable?
Of a sort.
The Terrace police themselves. We have an arrangement.
I'm aware of the compact. I just need to speak to the Synod, or at least Elder Vwafendal.
You shouldn't be here, lawman.
It's all right, Razal.
The three terracemen turned, then quickly bowed as an old terrace woman approached. Stately and white-haired, she had darker skin than Wax, and walked with a cane she didn't need. The woman, Vwafendal, studied Wax. He found himself sweating.
We tried to send him away, Elder.
He has a right to be here. He has as much terrace blood as you do, more than most.
The terraceman brute started, then rose from his bow, peering again at Wax.
You don't mean...
Yes, this is he, my grandson.
Wayne tipped the rum bottle up and teased the last few drops out into his mouth. Then he tucked the bottle into his coat pocket. It was a good bottle. He should be able to trade it for something. He hopped off the canal boat, giving a wave to Red, the boatman. Nice chap. He would let Wayne bum rides in exchange for a story. Wayne spat a coin out of his mouth. He'd been keeping it in his cheek and flipped it to Red.
Why is this wet? Were you sucking on it?
Allomancers can't push on my coin if it's in my mouth.
You're drunk, Wayne.
Red shoved off from the dock with his pole.
Not nearly drunk enough. That cheapskate Wax didn't even have the decency to stock a full bottle.
Wayne walked away from the post marking the canal side mooring and was faced with the most intimidating sight a fellow could see. The Ellendale University. It was time for Wayne's three tests. He reached for the rum, then remembered, a little foggily, that he'd finished it all.
Ugh, rust and ruin.
Perhaps he shouldn't have downed the whole thing. Then again, it made his sniffles easy to ignore. When he was properly smashed, he could take a punch or two to the face and not even feel it. There was a kind of invincibility to that. A stupid kind, but Wayne wasn't a picky man. He made his way up to the university gates, hands stuffed in his coat pockets. The etched letters over the top proclaimed in high imperial, "Wazing the always of wanting of knowing." Deep words. He'd heard them interpreted as, "The eternal desire of a hungry soul is knowledge." When Wayne's soul was hungry, he settled for scones. But this place was full of smart kids, and they were a strange sort. Two men in black coats leaned casually against the gates. Wayne hesitated. So they were watching for him out front this time, were they? The first of his three trials was upon him. Rusting wonderful. Well, after the nature of any great hero from the stories, he was going to do his best to avoid this particular trial. Wayne ducked to the side before the two men could spot him, then followed the wall. The university was surrounded by the thing, like it was some kind of bunker. Were they afraid all their knowledge would leak out like water from a swimmer's ears? Wayne craned his neck, looking for a way in. They'd bricked up the broken part he'd used last time. And the tree he'd climbed that other time had been cut down. Drat on them for that. He decided to follow another great tradition of heroes facing trials. He went looking for a way to cheat. He found Dims on a nearby corner. The young man wore a bowler hat and a bow tie, but a shirt that had the sleeves ripped off. He was head of one of the more important street gangs in the area, but never stabbed people too badly when he mugged them, and was polite with the people he extorted. He was practically a model citizen.
Hello, Dims.
You a conner today, Wayne?
Nope.
Ah, good.
Dims settled down on the steps. He took something out of his pocket, a little metal container.
Here now.
Wayne wiped his nose.
What's that?
Gum.
Gum?
Yeah. You chew it.
Dims offered him a piece of the stuff. It was rolled into a ball, soft to the touch and powdered on the outside. Wayne eyed the lad, but decided to try it.
Good flavor.
You don't swallow it, Wayne. You just chew.
Huh? What's the fun of that?
It just feels good.
Dims tossed Wayne another ball. Wayne popped it into his mouth.
How are things with you and the cobblers?
The cobblers were the rival gang in the area. Dims and his fellows went about with their sleeves torn. The cobblers wore no shoes. It apparently made perfect sense to the youths of the street, many of whom were the children of the houseless. Wayne liked to keep an eye on them. They were good lads. He'd been like them once. Then life had steered him wrong. Boys like this, they could use someone to point them in the right direction.
You know, some back, some forth.
There won't be trouble now, will there?
I thought you said you wasn't no conner today.
I ain't. I'm asking as a friend, Dims.
Dims scowled, looking away.
We ain't stupid, Wayne. We'll keep our heads. You know we will.
Good.
Dims glanced back at him as Wayne settled down.
You bring that money you owe me?
I owe you money?
From guards, 2 weeks back. Rusts, Wayne, are you drunk? It ain't even noon yet.
I ain't drunk. I'm investigating alternative states of sobriety. How much do I owe you?
20.
Now, see?
Wayne dug into his pocket.
I distinctly remember borrowing 5 off of you.
He held up a note. It was a 50.
You want something from me, I'm guessing?
I need into the university.
The gates are open.
Can't go through the front. They know me.
Dims nodded. That sort of thing was a common complaint in this world.
What do you need from me?
A short time later, a man wearing Wayne's hat, coat, and dueling canes tried to pass through the front of the university. He saw the two men in black, then bolted as they chased after him. Wayne adjusted his spectacles, watching them go. He shook his head. Ruffians trying to get into the university. Scandalous. He walked in through the gates, wearing a bow tie and carrying a load of books. Another of those men, who stood in a more hidden spot watching his companions chase Dims, barely gave Wayne a glance. Spectacles. They were kind of like a hat for smart people. Wayne ditched the books inside the square, then walked past a fountain with a statue of a lady who wasn't properly clothed. He idled only a short time and made his way toward Pashadon Hall, the girls' dormitory. The building looked an awful lot like a prison. 3 stories of small windows, stonework architecture, and iron grates that seemed to say, "Stay away, boys, if you value your nether parts." He pushed his way in the front doors, where he prepared himself for the second of his 3 tests, the Tyrant of Pashadon. She sat at her desk, a woman built like an ox with a face to match. Her hair even curled like horns. She was a fixture of the university, or so Wayne had been told. Perhaps she had come with the chandeliers and sofas. She looked up from her desk in the entryway, then threw herself to her feet in challenge.
You!
Hello.
How did you get past campus security?
I tossed them a ball.
Wayne tucked the spectacles into his pocket.
Most hounds love having something to chase.
The tyrant rumbled around the side of her desk. It was like watching an ocean liner try to navigate city canals. She wore a tiny hat in an attempt at fashion. She liked to consider herself a part of Ellendale upper society, and she kind of was, in the same way that the blocks of granite that made up the steps to the governor's mansion were a part of civic government.
You!
She speared Wayne in the chest with a finger.
I thought I told you not to come back!
I thought I ignored you.
And you... are you drunk?
No. If I were drunk, you wouldn't look nearly so ugly.
I can't believe your audacity!
Really? Because I'm sure I've been this audacious before. Every month, in fact. So this seems a right believable thing for me to do.
I'm not letting you in. Not this time. You are a scoundrel.
Heroes in stories never had to fight the same beast twice. Seemed unfair he had to face this one each month.
Look, I just want to check in on her.
She is fine.
I have money to give her.
You can leave it here. You distress the girl, miscreant.
Wayne stepped forward, taking the tyrant by the shoulder.
I didn't want to have to do this.
She looked at him, and to his surprise, she cracked her knuckles. He reached into his pocket quickly and pulled out a piece of pasteboard.
One ticket, admitting two people to the governor's spring dinner and policy speech occurring during a party at Lady Zobel's penthouse tonight. This here ticket lists no specific names. Anyone who has it can get in.
Who'd you steal that from?
Please, came delivered to my house.
Which was perfectly true. It was for Wax and Steris. But they were important enough folk that invitations sent to them had no names, so they could send an emissary if they wished. When it came to someone fancy like Wax, even getting their relative or friend to attend your party could be advantageous. The tyrant didn't count as either. But Wayne figured that Wax would be happy to not have to go to the blasted party anyway. Besides, Wayne had left a real nice-looking leaf he'd found in exchange. Rusting beautiful, that leaf was. The tyrant hesitated, so Wayne waved the ticket in front of her.
I guess I could let you in one last time. I'm not supposed to allow unrelated men into the visiting room, however.
I'm practically family.
They made a big fuss about keeping the young women and young men separated around here, which Wayne found odd. With all of these smart people around, wouldn't one of them have realized what boys and girls were supposed to do together? The tyrant let him pass into the visiting room, then sent one of the girls at the desk to run for Alriandre. Wayne sat down. He'd been stripped of weapons, bribes, and even his own hat. He was practically naked, but he'd made it to the final test. Alriandre entered a few moments later. She'd brought backup with her in the form of two other young ladies about her age, just shy of 20.
Smart girl.
Madame Penfor says you're drunk.
Alriandre remained in the doorway. Wayne tapped his metal mind, drawing forth healing. In a moment, his body burned away its impurities and healed its wounds. It thought alcohol was a poison, which showed that a fellow couldn't always trust his own body. But today he didn't complain. It also washed away his sniffles for the moment, though those would return. It was hard to heal from diseases with a metal mind for some reason. Either way, sobriety hit him like a brick to the chin.
I just like to play with her.
Alriandre studied him intently, then nodded. She did not enter the room.
I brought this month's money.
Wayne took an envelope out and set it on the low glass-top table beside him.
Is that really him? They say he rides with Dawnshot of the Ruffs. It's him. I don't want your money.
Your mama told me to bring it to you.
You don't need to bring it in person.
I do.
They stood in silence, neither party moving.
How are your studies? Are you treated well here? Is there anything you need?
Alriandre reached into her handbag and took out a large locket. She spread it open, displaying a strikingly distinct Ivanotype of a man with a wide mustache and a twinkle in his eyes. He had a long, friendly face, and his hair was thinning on top. Her father. She made Wayne look at it every time.
Tell me what you did.
I don't...
Tell me.
The third trial.
I killed your daddy. I mugged him in an alley for his pocketbook. I shot a better man than me, and because of that, I don't deserve to be alive.
You know you aren't forgiven.
I know.
You will never be forgiven.
I know.
Then I'll take your blood money. If you care to know, my studies go well. I am thinking of taking up the law.
Someday, he hoped he might be able to look into the girl's eyes and see emotion. Hatred, maybe. Something other than that emptiness.
Get out.
Wayne ducked his head and left. There should not have been a thatched log hut in the middle of Ellendale, and yet here it was. Wax stooped to enter, seeming to step backward in time hundreds of years. The air inside smelled of old leather and furs. The enormous fire pit in the middle would never be needed in Ellendale's mild weather. Today, a smaller fire had been constructed at its very center, and over it simmered a small kettle of hot water for tea. However, charred stones indicated that the entire fire pit was sometimes used. It, the furs, the ancient-style paintings on the wall of winds and frozen rain, and tiny figures painted with simple strokes on slopes were all fragments of a myth. Old Terrace, the legendary land of snow and ice with white-furred beasts and spirits that haunted frozen storms. During the early days following the Catasandra, refugees from Terrace had written down memories of their homeland, as no keepers had remained. Wax settled down beside his grandmother's fire pit. Some said that Old Terrace waited for this people, hidden somewhere in this new world of Harmony's design. To the faithful, it might as well have been paradise, a frozen, hostile paradise. Living in a land naturally lush with bounteous fruit, where little cultivation was required, could warp one's vision. Grandmother V settled down opposite him.
Did you remove your guns before entering the village this time?
I did not.
So insolent. During your long absence, I often wondered if the roughs might temper you.
They made me more stubborn, is all.
A land of heat and death.
Grandmother V crinkled a handful of herbs, flakes dropping into a tea strainer above her cup. She poured steaming water over them, then placed the lid with a gnarled hand.
Everything about you stinks of death, Asinthew.
That isn't what my father named me.
Your father didn't have the right. I would demand you remove the weapons, but it would be meaningless. You could kill with a coin, or with a button, or with this pot.
Allomancy is not so evil as you make it out to be, Grandmother.
Neither power is evil. It is mixing those powers that's dangerous. Your nature is not your fault, but I cannot help but see it as a sign. Another tyrant in our future, too powerful. It leads to death.
Sitting in this hut, the scent of Grandmother's tea, memories grabbed Wax by his collar and shoved him face first up against his past. A young man who had never been able to decide what he was, Allomancer or Ferrochemist, City Lord or Humble Terraceman. His father and uncle pushing him one way, his grandmother another.
A Ferrochemist slaughtered people in the Fourth Octant last night, Grandmother. He was a steel runner. I know you track everyone in the city with ferrochemical blood. I need a list of names.
Grandmother V swished around her tea.
You've visited the village on, what, a mere 3 occasions since your return to the city? Nearly 2 years, and you've made time for your grandmother only twice before today.
Can you blame me, considering how these meetings usually go? To be blunt, Grandmother, I know how you feel about me, so why torture either of us?
You cling to your images of me from 2 decades ago, child. People change, even one such as I.
She added more herbs to the strainer and lowered it back into the water. She would not drink until it was right.
Not one such as you, it appears.
Trying to bait me, Grandmother?
No, I'm better at insults than that. You haven't changed. You still don't know who you are.
I am not going to start wearing terrace robes, speaking softly, quoting proverbs at people.
You will shoot them instead.
A mixture of scents lingered in the air. From the tea? Scents like that of freshly cut grass. His father's estates, sitting on the lawn, listening to his father and grandmother argue. Wax had lived here in the village for only a single year. It had been all his father had agreed to give. Even that had been surprising. Uncle Edwarn had wanted Wax and his sister to both stay away from the place. Before his official heir, the late Hinston Ladrian, had been born, when Wax was 18, Edwarn had basically appropriated his brother's children and tried to raise them. Even still, it was hard to separate Wax's parents' will in his head from that of Edwarn. 1 year among these trees. Wax had been forbidden allomancy during his days in the village, but had learned something far greater, that criminals existed, even among the idyllic terrace. Wax looked up at his grandmother, meeting her eyes.
The only times I've truly known who I am are when I've put on the mist coat, strapped guns to my waist, and hunted down men gone rabid.
You should not be defined by what you do, but by what you are.
A man is what he does.
You came looking for a ferrochemist killer? You need only look in the mirror, child. If a man is what he does, think of what you've done.
I've never killed a man who didn't deserve it.
Can you be absolutely certain of that?
Reasonably. If I've made mistakes, I'll pay for them someday. You won't distract me, Grandmother. To fight is not against the Terrace way. Harmony killed.
He slew beasts and monsters only, never our own.
This again. Rusts. I should have forced Wayne to come here instead of me. He says she actually likes him.
A new scent struck him. Crushed blossoms. In the darkness of that chamber, he imagined himself again standing among the trees of the Terrace village, looking up at a broken window and feeling the bullet in his hand. And he smiled. Once that memory had brought him pain, the pain of isolation. Now he saw only a budding lawman, remembered the sense of purpose he'd felt. Wax stood up, grabbing his hat. He almost wanted to believe that the scents to the room, the memories, were his grandmother's doing. Who knew what she put into that tea?
I'm going to hunt down a murderer. If I do it without your help, and he kills again before I can stop him, you will be partially to blame. See how well you sleep at night then, Grandmother.
Will you kill him? Will you shoot for the chest when you could aim for the leg? People die around you. Do not deny it.
I don't. A man should never pull a trigger unless he's willing to kill. And if the other fellow is armed, I'm going to aim for the chest. That way, when people do die around me, it's the right ones.
Grandmother V stared at her teapot.
The one you're looking for is named Idashwi. And she is not a man.
Steel Runner?
Yes. She is not a killer.
But
she is the only Steel Runner I know of who could possibly be involved in something like this. She vanished about a month ago after acting very erratically. Claimed that she was being visited by the spirit of her dead brother.
Idashwi.
The syllables felt thick in his mouth, another reminder of his days in the village. The Terrace language had been dead once, but Harmony's records included it, and many Terrace now learned to speak it in their youths.
I swear I know that name.
You did know her long ago. You were with her that night, actually, before...
Yes. Slender, golden hair, shy, and didn't speak much. I didn't know she was a ferrochemist.
You don't even have the decency to look ashamed.
I'm not. Hate me if you must, Grandmother, but coming to live with you changed my life, just as you always promised it would. I'm not going to be ashamed that the transformation wasn't the one you expected.
Just tried to bring her back, Asinthew. She's not a killer. She's confused.
They all are.
Each time Marisi entered the precinct offices, she got a little thrill. It was the thrill of bucked expectations, of a future denied. Even though this room didn't look like she'd imagined, as the clerical and organizational center for the Octant's constables, it felt more like a business office than anything else. The mere fact that she was here excited her. This wasn't supposed to have been her life. She'd grown up reading stories of the roughs, of lawmen and villains. She'd dreamed of six guns and stagecoaches. She'd even taken up horseback riding and rifle shooting. And then, real life had intervened. She'd been born into privilege. Yes, she was illegitimate, but the generous stipend from her father had set her and her mother up in a fine home. Money for an education had been guaranteed for her. With that kind of promise, and with her mother's determination that Marisi should enter society and prove herself to her father, one did not choose a profession so lowly as that of a constable. Yet, here she was. It was wonderful. She passed through the room full of people at desks. Though a jail was attached to the building, it had its own entrance, and she rarely visited it. Many of the constables she passed on her way through the main chamber were the type who spent most of their days at a desk. Her own spot was a comfortable nook near Captain Aradel's office. His room felt like a closet inside, and Aradel rarely spent time there. Instead, he stalked through the main chamber like a prowling lion, always in motion. Marisi set her handbag on her desk, next to a stack of last year's crime reports. In her spare time, she was trying to judge to what extent petty crimes in a region foretold greater ones. Better that than reading the politely angry letters from her mother, which lay underneath. She peeked into the captain's office and found his waistcoat thrown across his desk, right beside the pile of expense reports he was supposed to be initialing. She smiled and shook her head, dug his pocket watch out of his waistcoat, then went hunting. The offices were busy, but they didn't have the bustle of the prosecutor's offices. During her internship there, beneath Dias, everyone had always seemed so frantic. People worked all hours, and when a new case was posted, every junior solicitor in the room rushed over in a flurry of papers, coats, and skirts, craning to see who had posted the case and how many assistants they would be taking. The opportunities for prestige and even wealth had been bountiful, and yet she hadn't been able to shake the feeling that nobody was actually doing anything. Cases that could make a difference languished because they weren't high profile enough, while anything under the patronage of a prominent lord or lady was seen to immediately. The rush had been less about fixing the city's problems and more about making certain the senior solicitors saw how much more eager you were than your colleagues. She'd probably still be there if she hadn't met Waxillium. She'd have done as her mother wanted, seeking validation through her child, proof, perhaps, that she could have married Lord Harms if it had been in the cards, despite her low birth. Marcy shook her head. She loved her mother, but the woman simply had too much time on her hands. The constable's offices were so different from the solicitor's. Here there was a true sense of purpose, but it was measured, even thoughtful. Constables leaned back in chairs and described evidence to their officers, looking for help on a case. Junior corporals moved through the room, delivering cups of tea, fetching files, or running some other errand. The competition she'd felt among the solicitors barely existed here. Perhaps that was because there was little prestige and even less wealth to go around. She found Aradel with sleeves rolled up, one foot on a chair, bothering Lieutenant Cabarel.
No, I'm telling you, we need more men on the streets, near the pubs, at night, where the foundry workers congregate after the strike line breaks up. Don't bother guarding them during the day.
Cabarel nodded placidly, though she gave Marcy a roll of the eyes as she walked up. Aradel did tend to micromanage, but at least he was earnest. In Marcy's experience, they were almost all fond of him, eye rolls notwithstanding. She plucked a cup of tea off the plate of a passing corporal who was delivering them to the desks. He quickly moved on, eyes forward, but she could almost feel him glaring at her. Well, it wasn't her fault she'd landed this position and the rank of lieutenant without ever having to deliver tea.
All right. Maybe there is a bit of competition around here.
You'll see this done, then?
Of course, sir.
Cabarel was one of the few in the place who treated Marcy with any measure of respect. Perhaps it was because they were both women. There were fewer women in the constabulary than among the solicitors. One might have guessed that the reason for this was that ladies weren't interested in the violence. But having done both jobs, Marcy felt she knew which profession was bloodier. And it wasn't the one where people carried guns.
Good. I have a debriefing with Captain Reddy and...
He patted his pocket. Marcy held out his watch, which he grabbed.
15 minutes. Huh. More time than I expected. Where'd you get that tea, Combs?
Want me to have someone fetch you some?
No, I can do it.
Aradel bustled off and Marcy nodded to Cabarel, then hurried after him.
Sir, have you seen the afternoon broadsheets?
He held out his hand, which she filled with paper. He held up the stack of broadsheets and almost ran over three different constables on his way to the stove and the tea.
Bad. I'd hoped they'd spin this against us.
Us, sir?
Sure. Nobleman dead, constables not giving the press details. This reads like they started to pin the death on the constables, but then changed their minds. By the end, the tone is far more outraged against Winsting than us.
And that's worse than outrage at us for a cover-up?
Far worse, Lieutenant.
Aradel reached for a cup.
People are used to hating Connors. We're a magnet for it, a lightning rod. Better us than the governor.
Unless the governor deserves it, sir.
Dangerous words, Lieutenant.
Aradel filled his cup with steaming tea from the large urn kept warm atop the coal stove.
And likely inappropriate.
You know, there are rumors that he's corrupt.
What I know is that we are civil servants. There are enough people out there with a mindset and the moral position to monitor the government. Our job is to keep the peace.
Marcy frowned, but said nothing. Governor Innate was corrupt. She was almost sure of it. There were too many coincidences, too many small oddities in his policy decisions. It wasn't by any means obvious, but trends were Marcy's specialty and her passion. It wasn't as if she'd wanted to discover that the leader of Ellendale was trading favors with the city's elite, But once she'd spotted the signs, she'd felt compelled to dig in. On her desk, carefully hidden under a stack of ordinary reports, was a ledger in which she'd assembled all the information. Nothing concrete, but the picture it drew was clear to her, even though she understood that it would look innocent to anyone else.
You disagree with my opinion, Lieutenant?
One doesn't change the world by avoiding the hard questions, sir.
Feel free to ask them, ma'am. In your head, Lieutenant, and not out loud. Particularly not to people outside the precinct. We can't have the men we work for thinking we are trying to undermine them.
Funny, sir. I thought we worked for the people of the city, not their leaders.
Aridel stopped, cup of steaming tea halfway to his lips.
Suppose I deserved that.
Aridel took a gulp, shaking his head. He didn't flinch at the heat. People in the office figured he'd seared his taste buds off years ago.
Let's go.
They wove through the room toward Aridel's office, passing Captain Reddy at his desk. The lanky man rose, but Aridel waved him down, pulling out his watch.
I still have 5 minutes until I have to deal with you, Reddy.
Marisie shot the captain an apologetic smile. She got a scowl in return.
Someday I'm going to figure out why that man hates me.
Hmm? Oh, you stole his job.
What?
Reddy was going to be my assistant.
They reached his office.
Had a damn fine bid for the job. I was all but priced into hiring him until I got your application.
Why would Reddy want to be your assistant, sir? He's a field constable, a senior detective.
Everyone has this idea that in order to move up, you need to spend more time in the office and less on the street. Stupid tradition. Even if the other Octons follow it. I don't want my best men and women turning into desk slugs. I want the assistant position to be for nurturing someone fresh who shows promise, rather than letting some practiced constable gather moss.
The realization made a lot of things lock into place for Marisie. The hostility she felt from many of the others wasn't just because she'd skipped the lower ranks. Many with noble titles did that. It was because they'd solidified behind Reddy, their friend who'd been slighted.
So, you think I show promise, then?
Of course I do. Why would I have hired you otherwise?
Corporal Maindew walked by, saluting, and Aridel threw the wadded broadsheets into his face.
No saluting indoors, Maindew. You'll knock yourself unconscious slapping your forehead every time I walk past.
Sorry, sir.
Aridel glanced back at Marisie.
There's something in you, Combs. Not the gloss and glint of the application. I don't care about your grades or what those zinc tongues in the solicitor's office thought of you. The words you wrote about changing the city, those made sense. They impressed me.
I thank you for the praise, sir.
I'm not flattering you, Combs. It's just a fact.
He pointed toward the door.
That broadsheet said the governor was going to address the city later this afternoon. I'll bet the second Octant constables ask us for help managing the crowds. They always do. So I'm going to send a street detail. Go with them and listen, then report back to me what Governor Innate says, and pay attention to how the crowd reacts.
Yes, sir.